right, here he is, Father Malachi Martin. Father?
Good morning, or good evening, depending on your
time
location.
Zone. That's right, time zone.
Time zone.
We're all
right.
Over the place.
You sound very good. You sound in good shape, Art. I don't know how you managed to remain always so chipper.
Well, it's simple. So, I think it's just like you, Father. We're both doing what we enjoy.
Yes, I suppose that is the secret. I remember the last man to say that in public was Jimmy Stewart. He said he was paid to do what he loved to do. So this is the case of the same thing, I suppose. Tell me this. On your mind, you had something about asking me about my background and training and that sort of business.
That's right. There have been a lot of inquiries, apparently, because you're a very public person, about your background and your training and how you came to the priesthood and what your current status is. So instead of my reading a bio, why don't you just go ahead and tell us?
Yes, I don't want to bore people enough. I think you'll always ask me a question if I'm obscure on any point. And it's quite short and brief in its own way, except I'll try and fill in the details where it's necessary to give a better picture. I was born in Ireland, of course, in Kerry, in Ireland, but way back in 1921.
Father, I'm going to ask you to get a little bit away from the phone, if you would.
Okay, what about this?
Much better.
Okay, it's a question of locating that speaker. And I joined the Order of the Jesuits. I joined it in 1939, just as war was being declared. In fact, I did it 3 days after we heard Prime Minister Chamberlain of England declare war on Germany. And Germany had attacked Poland. And I remained in Ireland for the duration of the war because we couldn't get out. It was dangerous to travel. And during that time, I got a university degree in Semitic languages and Oriental art and archaeology and history. And after the war, I taught. I went to philosophy for 3 years. It was the Jesuit rigorous training. And we went to philosophy for 3 years and got a degree from that. And then they had me teach little boys French and Greek for a couple of years. Every Jesuit had to undergo that teaching experience. Because if you can teach Greek and Latin to little boys who just want to get out of class, you have learned to teach. And after that, they sent me to Belgium to a place called Louvain, where I studied theology for 4 years. And where I was ordained a priest, a member of the Jesuit order, and I spent another 3 years getting a doctorate in Semitic languages, Oriental art and archaeology and history. And I did a special work published in 2 volumes on the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I spent a lot of time in the Middle East and studying the actual scrolls themselves. And I became an expert in paleography, that is, ancient handwriting. It all sounds very boring, but it was very exciting.
No, it's really not boring at all.
It was very, very exciting. And then they brought me back to Rome to a place called the Biblical Institute. That's the central part of the Vatican which trains professors of Bible. And I became a professor with tenure of Hebrew and paleography, and New Testament, and Old Testament, and of one or two other languages like Aramaic, which is used in the Bible,
yes,
and was the language to which Jesus spoke. But I arrived just down there in 1957, 58, and the old Pope, Pacelli, Pius XII, had died, and his successor was John the 23rd. And his great collaborator was a Jesuit called Father Baer, Augustin Baer, a German Jesuit who lived in Rome, had been in Rome for years. And he took a shine to me, and his room was just beside mine in the Jesuit house. And at that time, John the 23rd was very keen in establishing a new relationship with the Jewish community. So he brought me over to John the 23rd, who was very keen to have some young man, and I was in my 30s, some young man who was trained in Talmud, which I was, and in Bible and in the biblical languages, because John was setting up a huge network of relationships with Jewish organizations in Europe and in America. And because he was going to hold a thing called the Second Vatican Council,
mm-hmm.
which met finally in 1962 and lasted until 1965, lasted all 3 years. John died in the middle of it in 1963, but his successor, Paul VI, kept it up, and I was functioning all that time. But however, I had gone to my superiors in 1959, 1960, and said, look, I'm not satisfied the way things are going. And they said, why? Well, I said, because I don't agree with some of the policy decisions being made, and I don't agree the way these decisions are being implemented.
All right. May I, if I can, stop you there and
sure.
ask you a few specifics. What mm-hmm. did you disagree with?
I disagreed with changes, modernizations of the liturgy. And I disagreed also with the general trend in Rome at that institute was to diminish the age-old tradition about the nature of Scripture as being the Word of God. The dominant school of thought was a Germanic school which held that much of the Bible could be explained as a form of literature, as a form of popular myth-making.
Somebody's story.
Yeah. And that could, of course, if it were pushed, could affect the central beliefs that I had as a Catholic.
Of course.
Namely, the divinity of Jesus, the fact of the resurrection from the dead, and hell, heaven, and purgatory, and everything, finally. Because if you begin to throw doubt on the gospel stories, the historicity of the gospel stories, you're in trouble. And indeed, today, many Roman theologians will not state categorically that the resurrection of Jesus is a historical fact. They say, yes, it took place, but they won't call it a historical fact.
Mm.
It's a whole... It's what they call the higher school, or the school of higher criticism. So I couldn't agree with all that. And then there were other disciplinary matters, too. I thought that what had made the Jesuit order so successful was its inner discipline, and that was being loosened. But everything was being loosened in those days, Art. There was a spirit sweeping through the Roman Catholic Church as regards the old rules and the old discipline that resembled a tornado at its height.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, they decided that, all right, if you want to go, you can go. Now, but I was a Jesuit with four vows. There was poverty and celibacy, or chastity, as you call it, and obedience, and then a fourth vow of obedience to the Pope. There's a special core of Jesuits who have that fourth vow of obedience. It really means the Pope can call you in any morning and say, please depart for Tahiti and stay there and do such and such and such and such, and you can't ask for your ticket or for your support. You just do what the Pope says.
Let's see if I've got it right. Poverty, chastity, obedience,
and a special vow to the Pope of obedience, a special vow of devotion.
Uh-huh.
So I went to Paul VI, who was the Pope then, when I decided, this is 1964, and he said, all right, if you have to leave, you have to leave. I can dispense you from your vows. Which ones do you want to be dispensed from? So I said, well, I've got to earn my living, Holy Father, and for that I'll need to not have a vow of poverty, because my vow of poverty means I can't earn any money or keep any money. And he said, all right, and he said, then I have to release my vow of obedience, because I don't want to obey my superiors any longer. And he said, all right. I said, I want to keep my vow of celibacy, because I am a celibate and I want to remain celibate.
Mm-hmm.
The vow of obedience to you will be immediately, automatically dissolved. That's canon law, if I leave the Jesuit order. And he said to me, well, do you want me to find you a bishop? At the present moment, there are almost 2,000 bishops in Rome at the council. I'm sure several of them would like to have you in their diocese. So I said, no, I don't want to be under a bishop. So he said, well, they won't like that. He's very funny, really. He had a sense of humor all his own. We used to call him El Gufo, because he looked like an owl with his face, El Gufo. And he said, well, they won't like that. And you're not going to have a bishop? Where are you going to get your authority from? I said, you will have to give it to me, Holy Father, or your successors, by some special arrangement, but I want to be a priest, I want to be celibate, I want to write, and I want to have very active in TV and radio, and lecturing, and talking, and confessing, and there's a storm coming over the church anyway, which you yourself are always talking about these days, and indeed Paul VI was always talking about the storm let loose, like a tornado.
Yes.
He finally ended up by saying, as you know, in public, a couple of years later, the smoke of Satan has entered the sanctuary of the church. We are now invaded. Anyway, so we talked about that, and he said, all right. But he said, then, what you are asking for is this. There's a form which you know of called laicization. And he said, many people make the mistake of thinking that a priest like you who undergoes laicization becomes a layman. And he said, as you know, that's false. You never, never become a layman. Once you're a priest forever. But laicization merely concerns who has authority over you. And you want me to arrange it so that no bishop and no religious superior has control over you.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we'll have to make some special arrangements about that. Because he said, somebody must have some check on you. So he made those special arrangements, and there's always somebody in Rome to whom I refer my life to and discuss my money with. They don't ask for money, but they must know what I do with it. And they can always check on what I state in public if they don't think it is doctrinally safe.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, you won't be... You see, Rome is run by ministries. They're not called ministries in the Vatican. They're called congregations. And there's a ministry or a congregation for the bishops, and it's called the Congregation for Bishops, and then there's a ministry or congregation for clergy, and that's for clergy like priests, and so on and so forth.
So, you are still a priest?
Oh, yes.
You are simply a priest now who is allowed to write books and derive income from those books.
That's right, but I'm not under any of the congregations directly. Because I don't belong to a bishop and I don't belong to a diocese.
So you're a renegade priest?
No. In fact, a lot of people would like it if I were, because writing for all that length of time and talking to so many people over so much radio, they would like it if I swung away, because I'm really known to be fuddy-duddy conservative. And you know me as that art, I think.
Well, that, I guess I was conferring an honor upon you. I fully realize you're a very conservative priest, and in that sense, in light of today's church, you are sort of a renegade.
That's right, in that sense, yes. But the it sometimes puzzles Catholics, because they used to priests who are either members of religious orders or who are under a bishop in a diocese. And I'm not either of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And no congregation in Rome would claim authority over me. But I'm not alone in this matter now. There are well over 1,000 priests throughout the church in the same status as I occupy. But it's very hard to explain to people, because once they hear that you've been laicized, they say, oh, well, you're a layman, though. You're not, actually. We're not. I'm not.
So in every sense of the word, you are still officially a priest.
Oh, yes. Yes, and there's no doubt about that, whatever. It allows me a certain great latitude, but it also puts restrictions on me, because I can't back every political cause I'd like to back, because there are limitations on me for that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not supposed to... I don't think priests should be politicking.
That makes me want to ask you about your political views.
I have views, of course. I'd be a dumbbell if I hadn't got views. But to fling one's weight into a political fight, which I sometimes would love to do, I restrained myself because I think, between you and me, I think that the one thing Jesus dislikes is politicking clergy, because he had a lot of trouble with it in his day. So I think that...
I have to frankly wonder about the entire process of politics. In other words, to attain high office in this land today, Father, yes. It seems as though you must be an accomplished prevaricator.
It seems to me that you cannot do it with clean hands. I may be too condemnatory in that sense, although I'm not condemnatory. I hear confessions all day and forgive sins as a Catholic priest, as a human being. But it would seem that you've got to prevaricate, yes. You have to speak out of two sides of your mouth. You have to promise knowing you will not fulfill your promises, and you have to pretend you side with an issue because it's good for you for re-election.
Is that a sin? Would you say that even a good man trying to enter the political world to do good things,
yes,
would have to do what he has to do to get where he wants to go, to do the good things he wants to do?
Yes, it's complicated, but I think it's quite clear what you're saying. Well, I suppose that there are limits, you know. There are certain exaggerations that are now allowed, which are understood to be exaggerations. On a politician's mouth.
Father, hold on just a moment. We're at the bottom of the hour, and we'll be right back. Father Malachi Martin is my guest from New York City. I'm Art Bell, and this is CBC. Back now to Father Malachi Martin in Manhattan. Father?
I asked, there's a point in connection with what we were just talking about in the previous hour. And it's this, that you call me Father.
Yes, sir.
And priests are normally called Father. It has become the habit that if you're not called Father officially, since I have three doctorates, I chose to be called Dr. Martin or Father Martin. Many people have called me as that. And there's no difficulty with that, except, for instance, in the Archdiocese where I live in New York, the Archdiocese does not want any priest that's not part of the diocese, and I'm not part of the diocese, and not to wear clerical clothes,
yes,
brown collar and the black suit,
yes,
or not to be called Father, officially. But I just want to note that a lot of Catholics, they meet you for the first time and they find out you're a priest, but you're wearing a shirt and tie.
Well,
they find that shocking.
Is it okay to call you Father?
Oh, yes.
Good.
That's what I am, and that's where I profess to be.
Good.
I'm just noting that small point as a consequence of the status I sought to get. About politicking clergy, yes, about politics itself. It's a very, very trying affair for the soul, Art, I think, because you've got to make so many compromises.
Well... yes, and I, you know, I don't want to launch into a big political discussion, but I'll say this about politics. There was a day when I discussed it frequently, or even most of the time on the radio, and in the last years, Father,
yes,
it seems like what they argue about and discuss in Washington is more and more irrelevant to our lives.
Me too, it seems so. To me too, it seems so. And therefore, I'm not very interested, unless you wanted to discuss some political problem, case, situation.
Not me.
Not me either. I really I don't find it interesting. And then I find the majority of my fellow citizens, ordinary men and women, are not really exercised about it either. They have other problems and other considerations. And there's something new happening anyway, out there, as we say, with the demographers. There's something new happening to men and women. There's a new situation in the minds that I don't think the politicians yet have tumbled to. They don't know what's going on.
I would join them with that. I'm not sure I know either. I just know we are at the edge of momentous change.
Yes, we are. We are. There is a change taking place. And nobody can formulate it quite accurately yet. And I suppose until it becomes a de facto situation encased in laws and in practices and in the constitutional amendments, we won't know what it is. But there is a change taking place. And I can characterize it in a certain way, but it won't be a complete characterization. It's very hard to pin it down. But there is a change.
When I interviewed you, Father, it goes back...
At least a year.
A year, maybe a half a year at least. You made a statement that stuck in everybody's mind. You said, this spring, watch the skies.
That's right.
Now, there was a most remarkable event over Phoenix, Arizona. Most remarkable. Something gigantic hovered over that city to the point where Frances Barwood, one of the council women in Phoenix, called for an investigation. A gigantic hubbub. There have been things seen all throughout this spring in our skies that we normally do not see. I wouldn't characterize them as alien spaceships or devils or weather inversions or flares or anything else. Something is going on.
But there were these extraordinary phenomena, huh?
Yes.
Well, I'm very glad you've told me that because nobody else did. Nobody brought it to my attention. What I used to say, and it still holds retroactively, that if between the end of winter, 97, and the end of spring, 97, there were such signs in the skies, then that heralded something very, very awesome and something awesome and therefore fearful within say 6 or 9 months of that time. Certainly before winter of 1998 is over, and probably before this calendar year 97 is over. And I still say it.
This is the end of side one. Please leave the cassette exactly where it is, flip it over, and begin again.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Father, you said you worked extensively on the Dead Sea Scrolls.
I did.
How much of the information in the Dead Sea Scrolls is now not public, and will it ever be? And what do the Dead Sea Scrolls reveal?
Well, the answer to the first question, Art, is very simple. And it is a needed statement. There was, for quite a while, a constant rumor being repeated, especially in the popular press, that somehow or other, either Roman Catholic priests or Jewish rabbis or Jewish scholars or some group anyway, had found certain scrolls, certain writings from Wadi Gumran, that's the place in Jordan now, where the original writers of the Dead Sea Scrolls lived, at a place called Ayin Feshka, and that they, these, if they revealed these documents, that they would upset every traditional view of Christianity and Judaism. Now, we have examined every inch. The truth is, we have examined every inch of every Dead Sea Scroll. Every scroll produced in the scrollery, produced by the scribes, transcribing them by hand.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing extraordinary being kept from the public. What is being kept from the public is the publication of all the documents, because it takes a terrific amount of time to decipher them and to print them and publish them and translate them. But nothing has been hidden by a cabal of scholars, Christian or Jewish, and it gives a very false impression. That's the first thing to say, that it is all accessible. It now is all accessible, and as time goes on, it will be more and more studied and illuminated by scholarship.
All right, there are large unpublished portions
there
of
are.
The Dead Sea Scrolls.
There certainly are. And then sometimes it's not so much that they're large unpublished, But significantly, some things are small little scraps. For instance, only in recent years, Art, have we found out that one scrap, it's about the size of the palm of my hand, which is certainly from the scrollery, and which certainly dates from about 10 years after Jesus died, and presumably Jesus died by crucifixion in the year 33. But this scrap, coming from the scrollery in Wadi Gumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls place, the monastery as we call it, has on its back a quotation from the Gospel of St. Mark. And that is revolutionary, because that shows that the Gospel of St. Mark was circulating at that time. That would be about the year 45 or the year 50 A.D.
Mm-hmm.
And that is revolutionary, that mere small little fragment. And so on. There are other surprises to come. Now, there's one thing which we must keep in mind, though, and it's this. The soil in Palestine, the soil in that part of the country, that part of the world, I should say, that now it's mainly Israel, is a dry soil which preserves things.
Yes.
And I am certain, I will probably be playing a harp. I'm very hopeful about that part of my life, but I will be dead because I'm 76. But I think that in time, that land is going to yield ancient manuscripts. They will be found by archaeologists and published, and they will help revolutionize our entire concept of the Bible. For instance, Art, do you know we have no pre-exilic copy of the Bible? What do I mean by that? Well, as you know, the Jewish population of Palestine was led into exile in the year 594 by King Nebuchadnezzar. That was the exile to Babylonia. We have no copy of the Bible dating from before that time, no pre-exilic copy. I am certain there are pre-exilic copies.
So it's like the missing link.
That's right. And it's a funny thing, the further we get away from those events, way back 2,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago, 3,000 years ago, the more we find out about it. It's the inversion of history. So that is coming. Now then, about the significance of the scrolls themselves, they confirm everything we know about Judaism. There's nothing in them which is specifically Christian at all. At all.
At all.
At all. There's nothing specifically Christian. And, you know, Jesus, when he was taken prisoner one night, the night before he died, he was being interrogated. And the one of his interrogators said to him, "What have you been teaching in the streets? What's your doctrine?" And he came back very strongly. Jesus never turned the other cheek, by the way, ever. And at that same interview, by the way, somebody struck him across the face. Somebody struck him. He didn't turn the other cheek. He turned on the man and said, "Why did you hit me? If I've done something wrong, say so. If I didn't, what right have you to hit me?" But anyway, Jesus answers to the accusation that he was teaching doctrine, said, "I'm sorry, I have never taught." And then he used an expression in Aramaic, and in Greek, we have it in Greek, which is normally translated as "in secret." Basod would be the Aramaic. But Basod is the term used in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the official documents of the group of people who were there, to indicate their special meetings, their professional gatherings. So what he was telling his interrogator was, "Look, there are those fellows out there by Wadi Gumran, and they're revolutionaries, they're Essenes, and they're zealots. And they are your enemies, because they're revolutionaries. But I don't belong to them. I don't teach in their gatherings. I don't frequent them." So there are traces that Jesus knew about it, like that, in the New Testament, if you know how to read it. But there's no, in the Dead Sea Scrolls themselves, there's nothing specifically Christian at all. There's a lot, though, can be learned about the times in which Jesus lived and what people believed. And I could spend the next 3 hours going through the New Testament, pointing out where there's an incidence between Dead Sea Scrolls and the Gospels. But that's not really relevant for the moment.
All right. I want to ask you about about something very recent on the horizon, Father. There have been a number of people. There's a new book out by Mr. Drosnin, mm-hmm. Called The Bible Codes.
Mm-hmm.
And while I have not interviewed Mr. Drosnin, I have interviewed a man called Stan Tenen.
Yes.
And he has, for 30 years, been working on the ancient Aramaic.
Yes.
And claims to have, this is very interesting, to have deciphered, yes, indeed, a code in the Bible,
uh-huh.
in ancient Aramaic. Aramaic, I guess.
Aramaic, yes.
Thank you. And, and he claims, a most fascinating discovery, that these codes translate into geometric patterns that, if viewed, actually allow, for example, in Genesis, one to enter a state of experiencing not just what is written in Genesis, but what actually occurred. It's a most intriguing...
I must read that book out. I haven't read it yet.
So that and then he claims, of course, that some people have not come out of the experience as whole people anymore.
Really?
And that only those who are the most pure are able to have this experience. Anybody can have it, but not anybody can come out of it totally sane.
Gee whiz, I didn't know that. I must look at that book.
And I was wondering, I guess, have you heard about the publication?
Oh, I've heard about it, all right, Bible Codes. I've heard about it. And indeed, there has always been a tendency, not more than a tendency, there's always been the habit, especially amongst Jewish scholars, Talmudic experts, to read the bare words of the Bible, which is mainly Hebrew, but some Aramaic, but mainly ancient Hebrew, to read them in such a way that they get a double meaning out of it, and a more profound meaning than the simple meaning we take from the historical parts of the Bible. There's no doubt about that. And there's the art. Have you heard about an art called gematria?
No. What is that?
Gematria is actually it's a word used in the Talmud, the Jewish Talmud, but it comes from the Greek word geometry. But it's gematria is the use of the letters of words, say in the first line of Genesis is Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim v'ta'aretz. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth.
Yes.
But they take each letter and they give it a value, a numerical value.
Yes.
And they translate those numerical values into other words, more profound than the bare statement, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. It's called gematria. And sometimes the results are astounding. They really are astounding. And
do you consider it then possible, Father?
I consider this as a possibility. If you know something did happen, you find confirmation of it in gematria. But it's merely a confirmation. New revelations about God, new revelations about the evolution of mankind, new revelations about God's nature and about our destiny and about holiness and about the entire question of religious belief. No, I don't consider it reliable. You must have it beforehand, but gematria does provide a confirmation. There are books published on this, and you have to know math very well, and nowadays you must be able to use a calculator because you've got to run off a new calculator the value of a word.
Well, the man who published the work called The Bible Codes, Drosnin, claims that it is predictive, that it is prophecy.
Uh-huh.
I find that explanation far less elegant than Mr. Tenen's, which is that these geometric patterns produced by the Bible Codes actually okay. allow one to experience what is generally written in the King James Version, for example.
Yes.
And that's a very elegant explanation indeed, and if true, I can't say it's something I could try because I'm not nearly pure enough to try it, but...
Nor me, nor I. I do not feel that either. Then it goes against... I must say, I couldn't do it from the point of view of doctrine. because I don't believe that that's the way I'm supposed to find God. I'm supposed to find my belief. I have a far more, I would call it objective norm. That's not to attack anybody as subjective. But the difficulty is this, Art, that if I'm allowed to set up rules of interpretation, which I choose arbitrarily, because I'm just one single person, and with that I find out that I can predict such and such and such and such. First of all, people must wait to see, are those predictions fulfilled?
Yes.
Otherwise it's a fake. And while I'm waiting, I still am hanging on the subjective interpretation of one single individual. And that I find very shaky, especially if I'm seeking guidance for concrete decisions. Should I marry this woman? Should I have children? Should I invest in this business? Should I believe this? It's a shaky basis for concrete decisions I have to make. Is it honest of me to conclude such and such a deal? You know, and I need guidance. I'm a moral being, and I can be very immoral if I haven't got guidance.
Indeed. All right, Father, hold on. We'll be right back to you after the top of the hour news. Means you've got a pretty good break, so feel free to go and grab a glass of water or whatever and get comfortable, and we'll be back to you. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell, and there will be an announcement, I think we'll do it at midnight, with regard to what's coming up in Phoenix this coming Monday. If you get an opportunity, run up to the webpage at www.artbell.com and look at the live cam. Take a look-see and see what you think.